Darkness would not save them, for before they had reloaded the muskets, the enemy soldiers were already halfway up. They knelt on the lip and fired again, but this time their two shots brought down only one of the attackers, and the rest came on steadily. Schroeder sent another wave of climbers to join them, and the entire wall seethed with dark figures.
"Ah, we cannot beat them all back," Hal said with black despair in his heart. "We must retreat back up the gorge."
But when he looked up the steep, boulder-strewn climb, his spirits quailed. He flung down his musket, and with Abberley at his side, went at the treacherous slope. The first climbers came over the lip of the wall and rushed, shouting after them. In the gathering darkness, Hal and Abberley struggled upwards, turning when the pursuers pressed them too closely to take them on with their blades and drive them back just far enough to give them respite to go on upwards. But now, more and still more green jackets had reached the top of the wall, and it was only a matter of minutes before they would be overtaken and overwhelmed. Just ahead, Hal noticed a deep crevice in the side wall of the gorge, and thought that he and Abberley might take shelter in its darkness. He abandoned the idea, however, as he came level with it and saw how shallow it was. Schroeder would hunt them out of here like a ferret driving out a couple of rabbits from a warren.
"Hal Courtney!"
a voice called from the dark crack in the rock. He peered into it, and in its depth saw two men. One was Althuda, who had called him, and the other was a stranger, a bearded older man dressed in animal skins. It was too dark to see his face clearly, but when both he and Althuda beckoned urgently, neither Hal nor Abberley hesitated. They threw themselves at the narrow opening and squeezed in between the two men already there.
"Get down!" the stranger shouted in Hal's ear, and stood up with a short-handled axe in his hand.
A soldier appeared in the opening of the crevice, and raised his sword to thrust at the four men crowded into it, but Althuda threw up the pistol in his hand and shot him at close range in the centre of his chest. At the same time, the bearded stranger raised the axe high, then slashed down with a powerful stroke. Hal did not understand what he was doing until he saw that the man had severed a rope of plaited bark, thick as a man's wrist and hairy. The axe bit cleanly through the taut rope, and as it parted, the severed tail whipped away as though impelled by some immense force. The end had been looped and knotted around a sturdy wooden peg, driven into a crack in the stone. The length of the rope ran round the corner of the crevice, then stretched upwards to some point lost in the gathering gloom higher up the steep gorge. For a long minute nothing else happened, and Hal and Abberley stared at the other two in bewilderment. Then there was a creaking and rustling from higher up the funnel of the gorge, a rumbling and a crackling as though a sleeping giant had stirred.
"Saba has triggered the rockfall," Althuda explained,
and instantly Hal understood. He stared out into the gorge through the narrow entrance to the crevice. The rumbling became a gathering roar, and above it he could hear the wild, terrified screams of green jackets caught full in the path of this avalanche. For them there was neither shelter nor escape. The gorge was a death trap into which Althuda and Saba had lured them. The roaring and grinding of rock rose to a deafening crescendo. The mountain seemed to tremble beneath them. The screams of the soldiers in its path were drowned, and suddenly a mighty river of racing boulders came sweeping past the entrance to the crevice. The light was blotted out. The air was filled with dust and powdered rock, so that the four men choked and gasped for breath. Blinded and suffocating, Hal lifted the tail of his ragged shirt and held it over his nose and mouth, trying to filter the air so that he could breathe in the tumultuous, choking dust storm thrown out by the tidal wave of rock and flying stone that poured past. The avalanche went on for a long time, but gradually the stream of moving rock dwindled to become a slow, intermittent slither and tumble of the last few fragments. At last, silence, complete and oppressive, weighed down upon them, and the dust settled to reveal the outline of the opening to their shelter. Abberley crawled out and balanced gingerly on the loose, unstable footing. Hal crept out beside him, and both peered down the gloomy gorge. From wall to wall it had been scoured clean by the avalanche. There was no sound or trace of their pursuers, not a last despairing cry or dying moan, not a shred of cloth or discarded weapon.
It was as though they had never been.
Hal's injured leg could no longer bear his weight. He staggered and collapsed in the opening of the crevice. The fever in his blood from the festering wounds boiled up and filled his head with darkness and heat. He was aware of strong hands supporting him, and then he lapsed into unconsciousness.
Colonel Cornelius Schroeder waited for an hour in the antechamber of the castle before Governor van der Velde condescended to see him. When eventually he was summoned by an aide-de-camp, he strode into the governor's audience chamber, but still van der Velde declined to acknowledge his presence. He went on signing the documents and proclamations that Jacobus Hopp laid before him, one at a time. Schroeder was in full uniform, wearing all his decorations and stars. His wig was freshly curled and powdered, and his moustaches were dressed with beeswax into sharp spikes. Down one side of his face there were pink raw scars and scabs. Van der Velde signed the last document and dismissed Hopp with a wave of his hand. When the clerk had left and closed the doors behind him, van der Velde picked up Schroeder's written report from the desk in front of him, as though it was a particularly revolting piece of excrement.
"So, you lost almost 40 men, Schroeder," he asked heavily, "not to mention 8 of the company's finest horses."
34 men, Schroeder corrected him, still standing stiffly to attention.
"Almost 40, van der Velde repeated with an expression of repugnance. "And 8 horses. The convicts and slaves you were pursuing got clean away from you. Hardly a famous victory, do you agree, Colonel?"
Schroeder scowled furiously at the sculpted cornices on the ceiling above the governor's head.
"The security of the castle is your responsibility, Schroeder. The minding of the prisoners is your responsibility. The safety of my person and that of my wife is also your responsibility. Do you agree, Schroeder?"
"Yes, Your Excellency."
A nerve beneath Schroeder's eye began to twitch.
"You allowed the prisoners to escape. You allowed them to plunder the company's property. You allowed them to do grievous damage to the building with explosives. Look at my windows!"
Van der Velde pointed at the empty casements from which the stained glass panels had been blown.
"I have estimates from the company surveyor that place the damage at over 100,000 guilders."
He was working himself steadily into a rage.
100,000 guilders! Then on top of that you allowed the prisoners to abduct my wife and myself and to place us in mortal danger."
He had to break off to get his temper under control.
"Then you allowed almost 40 of the company servants to be murdered, including 5 white men. What do you imagine will be the reaction of the Council of 17 in Amsterdam when they receive my full report detailing the depths of the dereliction of your duties, huh? What do you think they will say? Answer me, you jumped-up popinjay! What do you think they will say?"
"They may be somewhat displeased," Schroeder replied stiffly.
"Ha! Displeased! Somewhat displeased!" shrieked van der Velde, and fell back in his chair, gasping for breath like a stranded fish.
When he had recovered, he went on.
"You will be the first to know whether or not they are somewhat displeased, Schroeder. I am sending you back to Amsterdam in the deepest disgrace. You will sail in 3 days' time aboard the Veil to Frieden, which is anchored in the bay at this moment."
He pointed out through the empty windows at the cluster of ships lying at anchor beyond the surf line.
"My report on the affair will go to Amsterdam in the same ship, together with my condemnation of you in the strongest possible terms. You will stand before the 17 and make your excuses to them in person."
He leered at the colonel gloatingly.
"Your military career is destroyed, Schroeder. I suggest you consider taking up the calling of a whoremaster, a vocation for which you have demonstrated considerable aptitude. Goodbye, Colonel Schroeder. I doubt I shall have the pleasure of your company ever again."
Aching with the governor's insults, as though he had taken 20 lashes of the cat, Schroeder strode out to the head of the staircase. To give himself time in which to regain his composure and his temper, he paused to survey the damage that the explosion had inflicted on the buildings surrounding the courtyard. The armory had been destroyed, blown into a rubble heap. The roof timbers of the north wing were shattered and blackened by the fire that had followed the blast. But the outer walls were intact, and the other buildings only superficially damaged. The sentries, who once would have leapt to attention at his appearance, now delayed rendering him his honours, and when finally they tossed him a lackadaisical salute, one accompanied it with an impudent grin. In the tiny community of the colony, news spread swiftly, and clearly his dishonourable discharge from the company's service was already known to the entire garrison. Jacobus Hopp must have taken great pleasure in spreading the news, Schroeder decided, and he rounded on the grinning sentry.
Wipe that smirk off your ugly face, or by God I will shave it off with my sword!
The man sobered instantly and stared rigidly ahead. However, as Schroeder crossed the courtyard, Mansier and his overseers whispered together and smiled behind their fists. Even some of the recaptured prisoners, now wearing chains, who were repairing the damage to the armory, stopped work to grin slyly at him. Such humiliation was painfully hard for a man of his pride and temperament to bear, and he tried to imagine how much worse it would become when he returned to Holland and faced the Council of 17. His shame would be shouted in every tavern and port, in every garrison and regiment, in the salons of all the great houses and mansions of Amsterdam. Van der Velde was correct. He would become a pariah. He strode out through the gates and across the bridge of the moat. He did not know where he was going, but he turned down towards the foreshore and stood above the beach staring out to sea. Slowly he brought his turbulent emotions under some control and began to look for some escape from the scorn and the ridicule that he could not bear. "I shall swallow the ball," he decided. "It's the only way open to me." Then, almost instantly, his whole nature revolted against such a craven course of action. He remembered how he had despised one of his brother officers in Batavia, who, over the matter of a woman, had placed the muzzle of a loaded pistol in his mouth and blown away the back of his skull.
"It is the coward's way," Schroeder said aloud, "and not for me."
Yet he knew he could never obey Van der Velde's orders to return home to Holland. But neither could he remain here at Good Hope, nor travel to any Dutch possession anywhere upon this globe. He was an outcast, and he must find some other land where his shame was unknown. Now his gaze focused on the cluster of shipping anchored out in Table Bay. There was the Veldefrieden, upon which Van der Velde wished to send him back to face the 17. His eye moved on over the three other Dutch vessels lying near it. He would not sail on a Dutch ship, but there were only two foreign vessels. One was a Portuguese slaver, outward bound for the markets of Zanzibar. Even the thought of sailing on a slaver was distasteful. He could smell her from where he stood above the beach. The other ship was an English frigate, and by the looks of her, newly launched and well found. Her rigging was fresh, and her paintwork only lightly marred by the Atlantic gales. She had the look of a warship, but he had heard that she was privately owned, and an armed trader. He could read her name on the transom, the Golden Bow. She had 15 gun ports down the side, which she presented to him as she rode lightly at anchor, but he did not know whence she had come, nor whither she was bound. However, he knew exactly where to find this information, so he settled his hat firmly over his wig and struck out along the shore, heading for the nearest of the insalubrious cluster of hovels that served as brothels and gin halls to the seafarers of the oceans. Even at this hour of the morning, the tavern was crowded, and the windowless interior was dark and rank with tobacco smoke and the fumes of cheap spirits and unwashed humanity. The whores were mostly Hottentots, but there were one or two white women who had grown too old and pox-ridden to work in even the ports of Rotterdam or St. Pauli. Somehow they had found ships to carry them southwards and had come ashore like rats to eke out their last days in these squalid surroundings before the French disease burned them out entirely. His hand on the hilt of his sword, Schroeder cleared a small table for himself with a sharp word and a haughty stare. Once he was seated, he summoned one of the haggard serving wenches to bring him a tankard of small beer. "Which are the sailors from the Golden Bow?" he asked, and tossed a silver rixdollar onto the filthy tabletop. The trowel snatched up this largesse and dropped it down the front of her grubby dress between her pendulous dugs before she jerked her head in the direction of three seamen at a table in the far corner of the room. "Take each of those gentlemen another chamber pot filled with whatever foul piss you're serving them, and tell them that I am paying for it." When he left the tavern half an hour later,
Schroeder knew where the Golden Bough was heading, and the name and disposition of her captain. He sauntered down to the beach and hired a skiff to row him out to the frigate. The anchor watch on board the Golden Bough spotted him as soon as he left the beach, and could tell by his dress and deportment that he was a man of consequence. When Schroeder hailed the deck of the frigate and asked for permission to come aboard, a stout, florid-faced Welsh petty officer gave him a cautious greeting at the entry port, then led him down to the stern cabin, where Captain Christopher Llewellyn rose to welcome him. Once he was seated, he offered Schroeder a pewter pot of porter. He was obviously relieved to find that Schroeder spoke good English. Llewellyn soon accepted him as a gentleman and an equal, relaxed, and spoke easily and openly. First, they discussed the recent hostilities between their two countries and expressed themselves pleased that a satisfactory peace had been concluded, then went on to speak about maritime trade in the Eastern Oceans and the temporal powers and politics that governed the regions of the East Indies and further India. These were highly involved, and complicated by the rivalry between the European powers whose traders and naval vessels were entering the Oriental seas in ever greater numbers. "There are also the religious conflicts that embroil the eastern lands," Llewellyn remarked. "My present voyage is in response to an appeal by the Christian king of Ethiopia, the Prester John, for military assistance in his war against the forces of Islam." At the mention of war in the east, Schroeder sat up a little straighter in his chair. He was a warrior, at the moment an unemployed warrior, and war was his trade. "I had not heard of this conflict. Please tell me more about it." "The great Mogul has sent his fleet and an army under the command of his younger brother, Sadiq Khan Jahan, to seize the countries that make up the seaboard of the Great Horn of Africa from the Christian king." Llewellyn broke off his explanation to ask, "Tell me, Colonel, do you know much about the Islamic religion?" Schroeder nodded. "Yes, of course. Many of the men I have commanded over the last 30 years have been Muslims. I speak Arabic, and I have made a study of Islam." "You will know, then, that one of the precepts of this militant belief is the Hajj, the pilgrimage to the birthplace of the Prophet at Mecca, which is situated on the eastern shores of the Red Sea." "Ah," Schroeder said. "I can see where you are heading. Any pilgrim from the great Mogul's realm in India would be forced to enter the Red Sea by passing around the Great Horn of Africa. This would bring the two religions in confrontation in the region. Am I correct in my surmise?" "Indeed, Colonel. I commend you on your grasp of the religious and political implications. That is precisely the excuse being used by the great Mogul to attack the Prester John. Of course, the Arabs have been trading with Africa since before the birth of either our Saviour, Jesus Christ, or the Prophet of Muhammad. From a foothold on Zanzibar Island, they have gradually extended their dominion over the mainland. Now they are intent on the conquest and subjugation of the heartland of Christian Ethiopia." "And where, may I be so bold to ask, is your place in this conflict?" Schroeder asked thoughtfully. "I belong to a naval chivalric order, the Knights of the Temple of the Order of St. George and the Holy Grail, committed to defend the Christian faith and the holy places of Christendom. We are the successors to the Knights Templar." "I know of your order," Schroeder said, "and I am acquainted with several of your brother knights, the Earl of Cumbrae, for one." "Ah," Llewellyn sniffed. "He is not a prime example of our membership." "I have also met Sir Francis Courtney," Schroeder went on. Llewellyn's enthusiasm was unfeigned. "Oh, I know him well," he exclaimed. "What a fine seaman and gentleman. Do you know by any chance where I might find Frankie? This religious war in the Great Horn would draw him like a bee to honey. His ship joined with mine would make a formidable force." "I am afraid that Sir Francis was a casualty of the recent war between our two countries," Schroeder phrased it diplomatically. And Llewellyn looked distraught. "I am saddened by that news." He was silent for a while, then roused himself. "To give you the answer to your question, Colonel Schroeder, I am on my way to the Great Horn in response to Prester's call for assistance to repel the onslaught of Islam. I intend sailing with the tide this very evening. No doubt, de Prester will be in need of military as well as naval assistance?" Schroeder asked abruptly. He was trying to disguise the excitement he felt. This was a direct answer to his prayers. "Would you look kindly upon my request for passage aboard your fine ship to the theatre of war? I also am determined to offer my services." Llewellyn looked startled. "A sudden decision, sir. Do you not have duties and obligations ashore? Would it be possible for you to sail with me at such short notice?" "Indeed, Captain, your presence here in Table Bay seems like a stroke of destiny. I have this very day freed myself from the obligations of which you speak. It is almost as though I have divine premonition of this call to duty. I stand ready to answer the call. I would be pleased to pay for my passage and that of the lady who is to be my wife in gold coin." Llewellyn looked doubtful, scratched his beard, and studied Schroeder shrewdly. "I have only one small cabin, unoccupied, hardly fit accommodations for persons of quality." "I would pay 10 English guineas for the privilege of sailing with you," Schroeder said, and the captain's expression cleared. "I should be honoured by your company, and that of your lady. However, I cannot delay my departure by a single hour. I must sail with the tide. I will have a boat take you ashore and wait for you on the beach."